Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, I'm Tim Burrows. This week we continue our review of the Mumbrella 360 conference, where I sat down with Paul Merrill, founding editor of Zoo Weekly. He discusses insulting his readers to build his profile, the multiple variations of the hand bra, and will ACP and magazines survive? Now, Paul, conveniently enough for us, has just published a memoir, or is just about to publish a memoir, but I was lucky enough to get to see a draft copy of it, which is fantastic, because it does all of your research for you in one very, very easy session. So I do recommend A Polar Bear Ate My Head when it's published shortly. It certainly gives a good sort of structure for chatting. And about halfway through our chat, there'll be a chance to kind of ask questions as well. So do start to have a think about that. Now, let me tell you about Paul. Paul Merrill was the launch editor of Zoo Magazine, both Zoo Weekly, both in the UK and in Australia. He also edited the UK Real Life, which I think I'm using with quote marks, magazine Chat. And before that, he trained on a very respectable local newspaper, and you can currently find him as a columnist in Encore magazine. So, Paul, let's go back to the beginning. The Farnham Herald, a very honourable local newspaper. What was life like on a local newspaper 20 years ago?
Well, I joined just as they gave up typewriters. So they, the Farnham Herald, which none of you would have read, is a very leafy suburb in Surrey in the UK, and the strict news filtering process was that if it moved, it was reported. So you go to council meetings where they're discussing hedgerows and the rowdies in the town centre and loft conversions. And it was not exactly zoo heartland, I would say, but it was a good grounding. I think the best journos are ones who are trained on local papers. Not that I'm one of the best, but
and what
the
was
others
your,
were.
What were your aspirations as a journalist then? What did you think you were going to end up doing?
Well, I was quite right on in those days, having gone to sort of uni in the late 80s and being very sort of right-on, left-wing kind of guy who was very much going to change the world and join a sort of proper newspaper like The Guardian or something like that. That was, I guess, my ambition. So joining my local paper seemed the first step on a glorious rise to the very top.
So you joined Chat Magazine?
Yes.
Eventually became the editor.
Yeah, Chat Magazine is... how would you describe Chat? Chat, I guess, is aimed at sort of northern working-class women in the UK, women who... perhaps, you know, three kids by different prisoners, lots of leggings, lots of very real but lovely women who bought it in their hundreds of thousands. I mean, it had a circulation of 600,000 a week by the time I left. And it was, again, nothing like Zoo. I'm not quite sure how Zoo came about, really. But Chat was very, it was just about their true life stories and about what happened to them in their lives and their loves. And most of it was scandal. It was usually my husband left me for then, you know, my best friends, my cousin, my girlfriend, the dog, the milkman, et cetera, et cetera. And it had puzzles in as well, which is, I guess, probably why most people bought it.
Also, of course, the competitions.
Competitions, yeah. We did have a few competitions in Chat.
Win a divorce?
We did win a divorce in National Marriage Week, which got us a lot of headlines. But it was a genuine competition, thinking, well, why should someone be trapped in a loveless marriage, not knowing how to get out, when we can make all their dreams come true and move them on to the next stage?
I'll challenge you on the word genuine a little bit later on,
yeah,
when we talk a bit more about
that's
the...
That's fair enough, I think.
...about the competitions. Now, you touched on the children by three different prisoners, which was kind of what put you on the mark in the UK media. You gave, in the UK, a somewhat infamous interview.
Yeah, I'd made a massive mistake... probably the biggest mistake I ever made, having been made editor of Chat and feeling very self-important and feeling like I'd made it and, you know, I was just becoming this celebrity and all fired up. I was interviewed by the industry newspaper, which was called Press Gazette. So a lady came in to interview my office and I was just plumped up thinking, oh, I'll just make her laugh, and rattled off loads of jokes, thinking, oh, this is going to be the most hilarious interview ever. But among my comments was the previous one I just used about most of our readers have three kids by different prisoners. They haven't let obesity stop them wearing leggings. And it went on. That was probably the mildest part of the interview. And I just went on and on, thinking this is just absolutely the funniest thing anyone's ever going to read. When it was published, I then got a call from my publisher saying, I think you'd better come upstairs. And basically, I'd done a, I don't know who's familiar with Gerald Ratner in the UK, the jeweller who was ruined because he slagged off his jewellery and basically made a joke about it and was ruined. I hadn't slagged off my product, I slagged off the people buying it, which I think is probably a step further. So huge, huge, terrible mistake. But it kind of got me, you know, talked about in a negative sense.
And what it did do, though, is it made the phone ring when they were, for the first time, launching men's weekly magazines. Somebody thought of you as a result of that.
Yes, which was, again, a big mistake on their part, I think, because I had no experience of the men's magazine genre. I'd read magazines like FHM in the UK and Loaded, which were great magazines back in the sort of late 90s and early noughties, but I had no experience at all. But this one interview, which I accept was a catastrophically bad thing to do, and I got away with it, but probably shouldn't have got away with it, was what kind of got me noticed to edit, to launch Zoo.
So tell me about the time that you were launching, you were launching what was a brand new genre. Now, we'll talk in a minute about when you did it here in Australia, but first of all, it launched in the UK. What, I mean, it seems obvious now. Sure, there's probably a gap, back in the days when magazines were booming. It's obvious now there was a gap in the market for a men's weekly magazine because there wasn't one.
Yeah.
What took the industry so long to wake up
to it? It's a good question because, obviously, women's weeklies had existed for nearly 100 years and people thought men didn't buy magazines. And that was genuinely true up until about the early 90s in the UK and Loaded magazine that came out and changed everything. Because before then, men's magazines were just very niche publications, mainly into fashion. FHM was a very small niche fashion title, and there was Esquire, and there was just a few other ones. But most people thought, rightly, that men didn't buy magazines, whereas women lapped up magazines, and there were probably 15 or so really big volume women's weekly publications that were all selling 300,000-400,000 up to about 1.5 million, I think the top ones were selling. So why no one had done a men's weekly up until 2004 is a really genuinely good question, because there was clearly a market for it, because we lead weekly lives and sports results happen weekly, and your life the weekend happens weekly, and there was no reason not to do it. So I think a lot of people ask, when Zoo and Nuts launched simultaneously in the UK in 2004, why no one had done it before, and it's a good question.
And maybe talk about a little bit things you wouldn't necessarily notice, like format, making decisions like just quite what size to do the magazine or how glossy the paper, all of those sort of decisions.
Well, the big problem we had with Zoo, so Zoo and Lutz launched at the same time, same week in the UK, and it was a massive, massive media furore. It was the biggest magazine launch together there'd ever been before or since in the UK. There was something like £25 million put in to both launches, and so it was just everywhere. We were interviewed on all the news programs, and it was in all the papers, big interviews, and there was this massive sort of Zoo versus Nuts, who was going to win, and debate that was going on. And we were quite smug because we had EMAP behind us, who did FHM, and they did a weekly magazine called Heats, which was the number one celebrity title and very successful. And when we saw a copy of Nuts, we kind of laughed and thought, oh, this is never going to work. No one's going to buy Nuts. This looks terrible. And whereas we were convinced that our product was the funniest thing ever committed to paper. And so we took along to these pub groups where we'd hire a room at a pub and go along and talk to 8 or 10 guys who were the potential readers. And we showed them Zoo and we showed them Nuts. And we put them on the table in front of them and said, well, okay, which one are you going to buy? Thinking, well, it's clearly going to be Zoo. And I think of the 9 guys there, all of them said Nuts. And we were saying, well, I wondered if maybe they'd misunderstood the question and, how could they possibly think this stupid magazine called Nuts that's not even funny? And they said, well, it's bigger and it's glossy, because they had glossier paper and it was bigger. I was saying, yeah, but how can you be so... Look inside. So they looked inside the magazine and they changed and they preferred Zoo to Nuts. But every group we did said the same thing. We'd buy Nuts because it was glossy and it was bigger and it looked like more value. And to be honest, it was probably better designed. And Nuts had a very successful TV campaign which everybody latched onto and everybody knew. And I thought, well, unless I'm in every news agency, tapping someone on the shoulder saying, well, you might think that magazine there is bigger and more glossy, but I think you'll find you'll enjoy Zoo much more.
And what sense did you get of the readers when you actually spent time in focus groups? Does it actually make you respect them more or less?
Well, learning from my mistake on chat, I decided I'd be wrong to criticise the readers in any way. Obviously, young blokes in their 20s are very simple needs, and clearly a sexy girl on the cover was going to be one of the things that we knew was going to be there from the start. Then it became about what else was going to be in the magazine, so gadgets and cars and sport. Obviously, mainly soccer in the UK was going to be a big part of it. But I think the other thing we were under pressure to do from the publishers and the bosses was to be quite clever, to be satirical, to spin the week's news, to be very topical, to be off the week. So if something was happening in the news, in the sort of mainstream TV news, we would say, what's Zoo's spin on it? So if Tony Blair had did something, then, you know, what's the Zoo take on it? Or if something's happening in the world. But you did focus groups, and you realise that in their world, they don't know what Tony Blair's done that week or anything. It's more about what game is released or what funny YouTube video they're all passing around with their mates or a car that's coming out or something like that. And it took us a while, I think, to realise that to be topical wasn't going to be about reflecting the mainstream news, which was our original thought. And instead, because you think to a young bloke down the pub who's age 18 to 24 or in probably any country, if you could be a fly on the wall to listen to what they're talking about, it's not going to be the stuff that you've seen on the ABC News. It's going to be other stuff.
You mentioned a reader called Brett and his somewhat simple tastes.
Yeah, there was one focus group we did up in Manchester, and we passed around the magazine and they were looking through it, and this guy called Brett, who was, I think, he was about 21, he was wearing a very stained Leeds United shirt and was bald and lots of tattoos, and he started laughing at this picture and just couldn't stop laughing. He was guffawing at this picture. So we sort of said, what is it? And he was pointing, could barely speak, and there was a picture, I'm sure you guys know Little Britain, the characters Andy and Lou. Lou is the guy in the wheelchair who's, you know, overweight, bald, and looks very simple. And he was laughing at him. Now, Little Britain wasn't known in those days. This was barely launched. And he was laughing because here was a paraplegic guy in a wheelchair who looked funny. And that was enough for him. We had to let him go because he couldn't stop laughing that there was a funny-looking guy in a wheelchair. So it made us think, well, overestimating and underestimating the reader are both things we need to be just get right.
You're being very careful these days not to criticise your readers.
I am. No, I'm being very respectful.
Even now. Now, I suppose the other perception around lads magazines, which was probably kind of created by Loaded, was that you have to live the life. You know, you've got to be a kind of gonzo journalist.
Yes.
And although there's the obligatory anecdote of cocaine at the launch party, you kind of strike me as a nice middle-class boy who's,
yes,
you know,
well, this was my worry.
A generation older than the readership.
There are men's mag editors who live the life, are snorting cocaine off strippers' boobs, like, week in, week out, and are going out getting pissed and having, you know, living the life. And I wasn't doing that. I was like a dad of two, living in very leafy Surrey, married and, you know, not living that life at all. But then I guess I wasn't also a chat reader and have been very successful in getting under the skin of the chat reader. So I guess for Zoo, I surrounded myself with people who were living that life and at times was quite jealous of the lives they were leading while I was kind of back in the office putting it all together. But no, I certainly wasn't your kind of stereotypical lads mag editor.
So what brought you to Australia?
Well, after editing Zoo for a couple of years, it was decided not only had it been a great idea in the UK, but we should roll out Zoo overseas. And I'd also already helped set it up in Spain, and there was also discussions around France in those days, and South Africa launched as well. And then it came to Australia. Now, EMAP had an operation in Australia, which had New Woman and some surf titles and some Australasian Dirt Bike and a few others. So it was decided that we were going to launch Zoo. So I was given the opportunity to come out just for a year to launch Zoo and then go back to the UK. So the Zoo launch in the UK was a complete fuck-up from start to finish, to be honest, and I take my responsibility as being a part of that. I mentioned earlier about Zoo and Nuts being this big battle about who would win. It was like Blur versus Oasis. It was huge, and they obliterated us. They thrashed us. A lot of it was because they launched better. The glossiness, the bigness helped as well. But clearly the Zoo launch had not been, you know, the success it perhaps should have been. So I haven't learned all those lessons, I was fairly confident that coming out to Australia, we could do a much better job. But the big fear was that ACP would get wind of it and they would launch against us. Now, ACP being the massive corporate entity with 55% and Kerry Packer very much alive and very aggressive in everything he did. So I had to come to Australia with my family and my pregnant wife, who was, I think, 5 months pregnant at the time with two young kids, and not tell anyone. So we told our very closest friends, but I wasn't allowed to tell anyone else that I was emigrating to Australia, because it was thought that if word got out, then ACP would beat us to it, and being the company they are, would just kill us, so we'd be, dead on arrival. So I came to Australia under this veil of secrecy, and as it was, Kerry Packer died like a month before we came out. We'd like to think it was because he, couldn't stomach the fight ahead of him. But as it was, ACP, apparently they did have a dummy ready to go. They were all set to take on Zoo, but in the end it was rejected by the board, and instead they built a gym for all their staff members, which is a very impressive gym, I have to say. But I was quite thankful they went for that option rather than Zoo.
In terms of the taste of the Australian audience, does it differ to the UK market, for instance, the market that you were used to?
It does, and this was quite a surprise to me, because Zoo UK is pretty full on. It's got topless girls, naked girls. It's got pictures of like bloodied wounds and injuries, and lots of swearing. And it's a pretty skanky kind of title, if you like. And since its launch, has actually got more and more base, and so has Nuts. Because when Nuts launched, its editor said that this is a magazine that dads and sons can read together. It's wholesome. And of course, that lasted about a month, and then it came down, and they were fighting really to see who could go from the to the gutter, and then from the gutter to the sewer, and lower, and more boobs, and that sort of stuff. So my preconception of Australia was that Australia would be very much the same, that the full-on Aussie guy who's doesn't care about anything, he swears and he's kind of there, but it wasn't the case at all. It was the opposite, and what we found was we showed Australians the UK edition, and they were horrified by it, because they hadn't got that heritage of Pastry of the Sun and the loaded glamour girls and the tabloid press, I guess. So we showed it to them, and they recoiled and said, well, they wouldn't buy it, because how could they read it in front of their girlfriends and their mums, and how could they read it on the bus or in the factory? So we had to temper the magazine and make it quite safe. So there were no nipples, for a start, and no terrible injuries. And everything was kind of watered down and blanded down a little bit, which, in the one sense, probably hurt us in terms of our appeal to the kind of your Bretts of this world. But I think long-term, it's probably a good thing, because there's more to Zoo than just the girls. I mean, obviously the girl is pretty important and always will be, but I think
Zoo... And you do share that amongst the girls. There are a number of photographic techniques you use to hide the nipples, including the hand bra.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, because we couldn't show nipples, we decided we'd have to be a way to show girls in a state of undress where you didn't show the nipples. So you get the hand bra.
Yeah, the hair bra.
Which we kind of invented, and now has its own Wikipedia entry, bizarrely. And the hair bra, which is clear. The girl bra, when you've got a girl on girl. You had like a house bra, which is up against a house or a wall. You get all these sort of different ways. It's a ridiculous, way of operating, really.
But, and, of course, the rug bra.
The rug bra. Yeah, if she's down on the floor, there's a rug bra. There's lots of different other types of bra. In some situations, she would actually be wearing a bra. But obviously that was, that more and more rare.
But there was more content than just the girls.
Yes. So the Australian Zoo was a bit more, it was more well-rounded, I think. There was more to it than just the girls. The number of girls in the magazine was less than the UK, and the sexiness factor was probably 20% less sexy, I would say, on average. And there were sometimes we clearly pushed it too far, but we had to be careful because we needed to be in supermarkets. And if Coles or Woolies, all it took was one mum to be in Woolies and with a 10-year-old son or daughter, and to object to a cover line or to think the girl looked too in your face, and we could have been pulled, because they're very conservative and they wield such power that we had to be ultra careful.
Did you feel that you had a responsibility, and I know you sat in on it, session before this one was Melinda Tankard-Reist,
yes.
Collective Shout. She was making the argument that the advertising industry, more widely the media industry, sexualizes and demeans women. Isn't that exactly what you were doing? And it's possible to kind of come up with a kind of bantery answer, but it's yes. kind of hard to get around that fact.
Well, okay, part of what she was saying was sexualization of children, which I, you know, there's no argument there. I mean, that's not something that men's mags are never pitched or marketed towards kids. I think this is an age-old debate about whether men's mags objectify women, whether they're a bad thing, whether they're very sexist. I mean, I remember going to university back in the late 80s, and, you know, we were all feminists, and we banned the Sun from our student union because it had, page 3 and anti-pornography, and it was all about trying to get 300 women MPs into Parliament, and everyone was campaigning, everyone was, anti-Maggie Thatcher, and everyone felt very angry about everything. So I was quite surprised when I became editor of Zoo, when I was getting sent pictures of, Australia's hottest uni girl and wet T-shirt competitions from, Wollongong Uni and all these kind of things, and girls sending pictures of themselves in, mainly taken by their boyfriends or by someone else. And that sort of anger or that sort of sentimentality seemed to have gone a bit. So I think that has been a step change. Maybe people realizing that actually, is it really doing any harm? It's a pretty girl on the cover of a magazine. We do everything to make her look as fantastic as possible. I would argue that's not objectifying women, that's celebrating women, that's putting them on a pedestal, it's making them look as fantastic as they can be. And I would say that, I've said this, gone through this argument so many times, I've lost track of whether I believe it or whether I'm just saying this to argue it. But I would say that magazines like the gossip mags, your likes of NW or Who or Famous, all they do is criticise women. They criticise women for having fat thighs or bad hair days or too much makeup or not enough makeup or looking 10 years older than they did 10 years ago. And just all those sort of things, everything is a criticism. Everything's, putting them down or they're, just... Whereas Zoo, whatever you think of it, it puts women on a pedestal. We didn't even have sexist jokes in the magazine just because we had an overall policy. We don't criticise women because we celebrate them. They're our girlfriends. There are, girls that we want to be our girlfriends. And so, I don't know if it's...
Sounds like the sort of thing a men's magazine editor would say.
Yeah, I think it does, doesn't it?
Not
you're right.
Know whether they believe it or
I kind of half
or not.
Believe it.
The thing is, let's address that point. When you say you half believe, is there a part of you that, do you think you might look back in 5 or 10 years' time and think, what was I thinking?
Well, I think my 18-year-old self would have been horrified at my current self, I think. But then maybe I'm more enlightened. I think... As I say, things have changed. My conscience is clear. I think Zoo is a magazine that celebrates women. It celebrates blokes, basically, being a bloke. And if you're 18 to 29, what do you want? You have very simple desires. You want to see a pretty girl on the cover. In fact, every single magazine, apart from Gay Mags and Men's Health, has a woman on the cover. So women's mags have a girl on the cover, and the likes of Vogue and Elle and Harper's, I wonder when the last time they had a girl on the cover who wasn't a size zero. In terms of sexualizing girls, underage girls, you look at the fashion houses and the way they have done that, the sort of the heroin chic and the sort of young girls made to look like they're sexualized. It's something that men's mags never go anywhere near. So the typical cover girl of Zoo would be a size 12 or something because men find curves quite sexy. Whereas if you look at the women's mags, they're all stick thin and not verging on anorexic, but actually fully anorexic. So, I think Zoo, I respect its critics, but I would say that, I sleep easy at night.
Was there ever a time there, because you see a lot of images week in, week out, you kind of thought, am I kind of losing my compass here?
Well, what do you mean, in terms of just becoming
Everything becomes normalised for you.
I guess that's true. I guess if you're in that environment and you are... You're judging women by their ability to sell magazines rather than anything else. And yeah, I guess you do become slightly your opinion changes. But having said that, I think I knew what sold the magazine, and increasingly we were trying to sell a magazine with humour, with the sort of stupid competitions and the kind of crazy stuff that we were getting PR for, as much as the actual girls.
What made you finally move on?
From Zoo?
Yeah.
Well, I edited exactly 365 issues, which so one for every day of the year. And I was, you know, getting on a bit myself, and I figured there had to be more to life. And I'd always wanted to write, and of course, being editor of Zoo, that, you know, the longest articles are about 30 words, and, you know, we have one and two syllable words. I think the only five syllable word is probably nymphomaniac. So it's not an environment where you can sort of, you know, and embrace your creative juices like that. So I fancied a change, and so I took the plunge.
I think you talk about headline, talk about words. A favourite headline was Jet Goes Bang.
Jet Goes Bang. Well, that would, I guess the other thing with Zoo Readers is you have to tell it like it is. So if I didn't believe in puns in headlines, so everything had to be pretty straight. So Jet Goes Bang was a picture of a jet that was going bang. And that's kind of, you know, that was the way we kind of, you know, made it easy for our readers.
Well, in a minute, we'll take a question or two if they are. So have a bit of a think if there's something that you'd like to come in on. Let's talk about, obviously, an important aspect for any editor is PR, is driving media coverage. And one of your kind of very sort of tactics, strategies used again and again was the competition that would create outrage.
Yes.
Was that quite cynically done?
Yeah. Well, we did... I think Zoo had to become talked about, and I think for the first two or three years of Zoo's existence, it was the most talked about magazine in Australia for good or bad reasons. So when we did Win a Boob Job for Your Girlfriend, Win a Divorce in National Marriage Week, when we did Win a Circumcision, Win a Month's Supply of Lesbians,
Win a Cannibal Sex Holiday,
Win a Cannibal Sex Holiday.
Australia's Naughtiest Nana.
Yeah. We did lots of competitions that all kind of got us talked about, you know, or criticised for or whatever it was. My favourite was we did Win a Date with Michelle Obama when she was due to come over. And the way it worked is that we bought a date, like a dried fruit, and we chopped it in half, and we sent half to the White House, and the reader could win the other half. So you're technically sharing a date, having a date with Michelle Obama. Legal?
Another similar one that you could see the advertising watchdog taking a view on, Win a Time Machine.
Win a Time Machine. Well, Win a Time Machine, you know, it was a good cover line. You turn inside, it's actually a clock, which technically is a time machine. We also did Win 72 Virgins on the cover, which turned out to be a book by Boris Johnson called 72 Virgins.
Well, let's see if does anyone want to come in with a question at this point? We have a roving microphone. Yeah, it's a bit bright up here, so kind of wave vigorously if... Oh, there we go.
Hi, Adam Joseph, Growth Solutions Group. The Zoo readership seems very much about Generation Y. You mentioned 18 to 29-year-old as being the core. Obviously, there's a new generation coming up, Generation Z, born 1995 to 2009. So, you know, the oldest one will be 17, but that's surely the next generation of readership. What things will you be doing to remain relevant to Generation Z?
Well, it's a good question. I think what's happening with all magazines is circulation is going down and down, mainly because the young people coming in are no longer buying magazines, because why would you buy a magazine when you've got the entertainment through your phone? So I think the brands that will succeed will be the ones that translate to iPads or smartphones or apps and can still deliver what the old print version delivered, but in a different way. In terms of what the tone will be, I think that's a good question. I'm not sure what it will be. Having spoken to a lot of young people, having lived and breathed these kids for the last 8 years, I know humour is very important. So anything that makes them laugh, they're naturally drawn to. So Zoo becomes like a filter of the internet. So rather than trawling through a billion videos on YouTube or funny websites, you get a digest within the pages of Zoo. So that, I think, will continue whatever medium the magazine continues into. And beyond that, I guess, whether girls will continue to be so important, I don't know, because you can get them everywhere else. I guess magazines like Zoo or men's brands might become a little bit more specialist. My own view is that the last magazine standing in print will be the specialist ones like Model Railway or people are collecting coins or something, because the more mainstream ones will have all just been rendered benign by the sheer volume of websites out there.
Is there another question at this stage? Yeah, I see a hand over there. Do you mind telling us who you are and where you're from, please, Damien?
Damien Pinkus from The Works. And Paul, I know you had a bit of an obsession with midgets. Do you think they'll always be funny?
Well, midgets and old people, I think, especially old midgets, I don't think you can go far wrong. We did seem to have an obsession with midgets. Maybe that came from me. And that, you know, whenever we did a Christmas gift guide, of course, there's a picture of a sexy girl with a dwarf dressed as an elf. And we did a day in the life of a dwarf one time. I got one of my reporters, who was 6'5", to become a dwarf for the day and see what it was like. And that, you know, went down pretty well. And we sponsored a dwarf boxing match up in the Gold Coast, which was televised live on one of the Sky pay channels. And the dwarves, you know, I think, to be fair, like Lord of the Rings, I think we were giving them gainful employment that they might have not, you know, had elsewhere.
So there's a question shouted.
We did actually try to...
Just repeat that so everyone can hear. Did you ever think about giving away a midget?
Giving away a midget. We did think about giving a prize as win a midget for the day, and you could decide what that midget does, whether he, like, you know, brings you drinks or whatever it is. But and then we were told that actually that might be too offensive and we'd, you know, we'd get probably taken out of Woolies.
Which does sort of... I find myself thinking...
Unless we stacked on a higher shelf at Woolies so that they couldn't be too offended.
I find myself thinking of the moral compass question.
Yeah, I know. You're. I'm kind of talking myself out of... the moral high ground, aren't I?
But going back to something you said earlier, you talk about the women always look good.
Yes.
Photoshop.
Yes.
How big a part does that play in the images that we see in a magazine like Zoo?
Well, it plays a part. I mean, every image is photoshopped and airbrushed, but not as much, I would guess, as some of the women's mags. I mean, the girls in Zoo are fairly... regular looking. The idea is that they should look like the girl next door. That's the kind of image we're going for. Wholesome, girl next door, usually smiling. There's no kind of, if you look at the girls on the cover, usually they haven't got that sort of pouting, come fuck me kind of look, because that immediately kind of, you know, makes it look a little bit more, I would say, offensive or liable to get stripped out of a supermarket. So the girls were supposed to look kind of wholesome, girl next door, with big boobs.
You also had a marketing budget. You did some advertising. Tell me about the experience of being a client.
The ads were just so terrible. If the person was in this room who made those ads, then he should hang his head in shame, Damien. Well, the ads...
No,
they were good ads. They were
sorry,
very good,
Damien,
ads.
But they don't come out that well in the book.
No, well, no. The ads we launched with were fine. They were good.
Fine.
And...
Fine, Damien.
Fine. No, they're probably more than fine. But the ad that everyone remembers for Zoo is the Zoo office. So we did our actual office, and we had a bloke in a gorilla suit, someone with a barbecue, someone with a motorbike, we had a girl on a swing, and we probably had a dwarf there somewhere. But and the idea was toughest working conditions on Earth. So, you know, this zoo is supposed to look, you know, like it's this is what the Zoo office is like. I wasn't allowed to play the editor. We got a kind of male modelish ex-neighbors actor to play the editor who had his brow being mopped by a beautiful woman, and that was the kind of idea of what everyone assumed the Zoo office looked like. In fact, the Zoo office looked like a call center in Newcastle. It was, you know, just everyone's sort of tapping at their typewriters, but trying to create this image of Zoo as being this amazing place to work where everyone wants to, everything is crazy and all going off, and whereas in fact it kind of wasn't going off.
And there was another marketing campaign that you struggled with more.
Well, the final marketing campaign I did struggle with because this wasn't Damien's fault, because it was we had this great idea for these ads, and then we were told the day before the shoot that we couldn't do the punchlines on some of them because they were too offensive, or that it could only be shown after 9 o'clock or something. So
what was the idea?
One of the ideas was you had I think it was a waxing clinic, and a girl walking in, and there's a guy with a leaf blower. And off camera, he clearly blows up the skirt, and it's, you know, Zoo, you know, that's Zoo, whatever. But then we were told, no, you can't do that because that's clearly offensive, which is right, I guess. So we shot it without the punchline, and it kind of just all looked a bit strange. And those ads, I think, are still running. They're just, you know, not good.
Any more questions from the floor? I see a hand just there, and then we'll go there afterwards.
Andrew Coates from Beam. What was the scariest idea you didn't do?
Scariest what?
Idea, marketing idea that you didn't do.
Well, I did. I wanted to do wind voluntary euthanasia for a loved one, because we figured this is something I tried in the UK. Actually, we obviously a serious subject that, you know, a lot of people have terminal illnesses, and you're not allowed. Assisted suicide's illegal, and there's no Dr. Nitschke in the UK who's kind of helping these guys. So we looked into the Digitus clinic in Switzerland, which where you can obviously get a one way ticket, and you plug yourself in and blah blah blah. So we thought, you know, win, this will be a great competition. We called it Love and Let Die, which I thought, you know, summed up the sentiment behind it. But we were told that actually that's, we would be complicit in murder and, you know, and also reducing our readership by one, so it was, we weren't allowed to do it.
And a question at the front as well.
Yeah, it's Jason Davis here. I look forward to reading your book. I wonder, I suppose the other spectrum of that question is that, is there anything you did do that you did regret?
Oh, probably plenty, yeah. I think the one thing I did which got me in a lot of shit with my wife was I became pen pals with Carl Williams, you know, the murderer, Underbelly star, because I was trying to get in to see him to get an interview with Carl Williams. I think this would be fantastic to do this, because we'd shot his wife Roberta for the magazine and got lots of PR, and so I became, you know, got to know her and then Carl and everything. But I made the mistake of, to be allowed to visit a murderer, you have to give your details to the prison authorities. So Roberta rang me up and said, you know, can you just give me your address? It's all looking good. So I said, yep, gave her the address. And then she was on the phone to Carl at the same time. So she then repeated it to Carl. And then he started writing to me and sending me these cards, you know, these with a very sort of girly handwriting, which made me doubt it was him at first, but it turned out it was him. And then after he died, after he was, you know, killed with the exercise bike, we kind of, you know, being zoo, we ran some stupid jokes about, you know, our exercise bike over my dead body and all that sort of stuff. And then I got a call from one of his associates saying, we know where you live. We're going to come round. We're going to murder you. You know, I know people who've got nothing to lose in your area. You know, you're going to die. You know, how dare you fucking... Da-da-da. So I thought, oh, fuck. Not only, you know, thinking of maybe he hasn't got the address. I was thinking Carl's probably scrawled my address up on his cell wall. So I sort of made the mistake of not telling my wife for a few days, which, you know, I was being offered police protection by ACP and saying, oh, maybe you should move out to a safe house for a while. And I thought, should I tell her? I should probably tell her, but I don't want to worry her. So it didn't go down too well when I finally had to sort of fess up. And she was saying, well, why? I said, well, just be careful when you open the door. I said, well, what do you mean be careful when I'm opening the door? So that was probably a mistake. I wouldn't necessarily give my address out quite so freely again.
Well, that's an amazing story. The other question, if I can jump in quickly, is Zoo has always been to me a bastion of acceptable bad taste. Do you feel that the goalposts move, you know, annually of what's acceptable in terms of bad taste when you're talking about a picture of a plane exploding, or, you know, was there ever too soon for Zoo with jokes and...
Sometimes. I mean, when the week Michael Jackson died, we did 50 best Jacko jokes, which we felt was okay, because clearly when someone dies, they're all going around on the internet very quickly. We nearly came badly unstuck in our first year. In fact, we compiled a list called 50 People We Hate, which we just made up. And I think Carl Sanderlands was top the first year, and Steve Irwin was quite high up. And to make the images look more interesting, we sort of did, you know, scribble cartoons on the pictures. So we did, tattoos on someone, or we did like a sort of, you know, dunce's hat on someone. And Steve Irwin was in the list, and we did like a knife coming out of his chest.
And he was still alive at this point.
He was still alive at this point. And we were going to press on the, whatever day of week it was, the Tuesday or Wednesday. And my chief sub said, oh, there's a report, you know, someone says the crocodile hunter's dead. And it was the day he was killed. So we would have come out, had this been 6 hours later, we would have come out with a picture of a stab wound, just probably where the stingray went in. So we quickly, hastily took him out of the list and put the stab wound in someone else. And we did a 4-page Steve Irwin tribute. What a wonderful guy this guy is. We did a recipe for stingrays just to sort of, you know, emphasize how much we loved him. But we were very close to coming badly unstuck.
Now, you mentioned ACP. Along the way, EMAP got bought by ACP, which is how you ended up in the ACP stable. How do you see the future for ACP and for magazines?
I think magazine brands will survive because people still want, if they're buying Women's Weekly, they still want the recipes. If they're buying Women's Day, they still want the gossip. But I think they'll exist in different ways. So I would say in 10 years' time, there might not be many print magazines left, but the brands will still be there. And I think ACP is very in a good place right now. I think it's clearly the market leader. It's very innovative, and I think it's got the right guy in charge, and it's going really well. And I think they are pushing the new technology, and I think ACP are in a great position.
And the secret for magazine publishers to survive is about investing in new platforms.
It has to be. I think one of the problems ACP has is because there's all these rumours about them being bought. The same with Pacific. So the investing in a brand and like a 5 or 10 year plan is impossible. But I think that's what they've got to do, because I think if anyone who's coming to buy a magazine company would clearly not want to buy a company that's not future-proof. So there has to be some investment, some bottom-line sacrifice in the next 2 or 3 years to make sure that they are existing in 5 to 10 years.
Is there another question from the floor?
Hi, I'm Nicola. I'm from PhD. We're a media agency. And my question is around how Zoo as a property work with brands. And coming from the UK, my client, O2 telco over there, would never let us put an ad in Zoo, even though the target audience was absolutely spot on for a couple of their products. So kind of, I guess, two-point question is, can you give us any insight into where you unwillingly had to maybe dilute the Zoo offering to get that advertising dollar? And can you just give us an interesting sort of story about, you know, when the property and the brand worked really well? I'm thinking maybe links might be in there.
Links.
Well, links have advertised in Zoo hugely over the years, and links are an advertiser who embraced the kind of sexiness. One of the things, I mean, Zoo, I guess, was going after advertisers initially that were probably unrealistic, that people didn't want to advertise in Zoo. The other way that happens is that there are some companies that clearly need the Zoo audience but didn't want to be seen in Zoo. So there was one campaign for Holden where we gave them loads of editorial, but they weren't seen to put a display ad in the magazine. And there's other things where we do maybe more advertorial-based stuff or experiential, where it's not just about the straight display. I think display ads are kind of, you know, have had their day, and people now, it's all about added value. It's about adding some more experience to that. And Zoo's had some pretty good customers. I mean, the biggest advertiser in Zoo since launch has been the federal government. So they haven't seen an issue with the magazine. A lot of car companies, a lot of telcos, you know, a fair amount of blue chip products that you probably will be surprised at have all not had a problem with the magazine. One of the revenue streams that we have lost, and I thought a lot of other magazines have, are the phone lines. You know, the sex lines you get, ring this number for a hot granny and all that sort of stuff. That market has just collapsed on itself under more and more regulation. So now it barely exists. But the main sort of higher end companies don't seem to have an issue with it.
You mentioned Carl Sunderland. Let's talk about a few of the Australian celebrities that you have had dealings with. So Kyle, it became a bit of a kind of hate-hate relationship, really.
It was hate-hate. We put him top of the hate list, as I say, in year one. And he, to be fair to him, happy on his show and talked about it. I think he was quite pleased that he'd come top of a list because he'd never done that before. We kind of then Kyle started slagging us off on his show. He just every opportunity was to criticise Zoo, to slag us off, to call us a bunch of dickheads. This went on and on. So when it came to his wedding day, to Tamara, we hired some motorbikes with big display ads behind them and put big slogans saying, you can do better, Tamara, it's not too late, and parked outside the church. So when they turned up, they saw these ads. So we were going to get a skywriter to do something, but we figured we wouldn't have enough letters.
Another high-rent celeb, Lara Bingle.
Yeah, Bingle was a problem. We in our fifth issue, we ran a cover of Lara, but this was when she just started the tourism campaign, Where the Bloody Hell Are You? So we ran a picture of her saying, bloody hell, it's Lara, first men's mag shoot. And inside there was a speech bubble of her, and it said, I'll make you come, clearly meaning to Australia. But she took offense to this and sued us, and it cost us a lot of money. But I think we figured we made so much out of it for publicity, it was probably worth the hassle.
Now, we are, I think, out of time, so we'll have to wrap it up here. But, guys, please do buy the book when it comes out, A Polar Bear Ate My Head. And when is it out?
It's out the 1st of August.
And in the meantime, please thank Paul.
Thanks for listening to The Mumbrella Cast. See you next time. Toodle-pip.